is well prepared to protect the country's territorial integrity and has full control over the airspace of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Winter is coming, and from the looks of things, it will be a long, harsh, and very cold one. But at the same time, the world is in the midst of an unprecedented energy crisis, with dire economic, social, and political ramifications. Brent crude has surged to a five-year high of over $80 per barrel, while gas prices are up over 500% year on year. The International Energy Agency says the global energy crunch is expected to boost oil demand by about 500,000 barrels a day. Analysts say the energy crisis is rooted in soaring demand as the economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic takes hold, and the production level has simply failed to keep up with demand. However, some immediate measures could easily resolve this crisis. One such fix would be the removal of US sanctions on Iran, which enjoys one of the largest hydrocarbon reserves in the world. The flow of Iranian oil into the global market, for example, would be vital in easing the crisis.
Until a couple of months ago, it was not very important for the world that Iran is under sanctions because supply exceeded demand. But the current trends in the global market may put pressure on consumer countries, Europeans and countries like India and China or U.S. allies to push Washington to lift sanctions.
Iran has repeatedly underlined its ability to swiftly increase its crude production to help alleviate the global shortage. Its oil minister recently said people in the United States and some European countries are paying the price for their leaders' unwise policies. Javad Oji stressed that Iran on several occasions displayed its goodwill to help stabilize the oil market and resolve the global energy crisis, but U.S. sanctions are standing in the way. People in Lebanon, who have been facing gasoline and diesel shortages and electricity blackouts, bear witness that ways are found where there is mutual will. Iran has recently been delivering shipments of fuel to energy-starved Lebanon, despite U.S. sanctions targeting both countries. That was achieved through the determination of both Iran and the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. Iran had also earlier dispatched fuel shipments all the way to Venezuela. Now, as millions of people around the globe are bracing for a hard and long winter, it's worthwhile to ask how much of the ordeal could be averted through a similar international resolve.
Fear is growing in Indian-controlled Kashmir following a series of shooting incidents across the region that killed around a dozen civilians, including four non-local workers. The fear doubled among the non-local residents after police said non-locals should reach army camps and police stations. Dhananjit Kumar has been working in Kashmir for the last 12 years. Each year he stays here for 6 months and returns home with his hard-earned money. But this year he's moving ahead of time.
My family back home is worried. They insisted upon my return. I have worked for so many years here, but I have never seen such chaos. The situation here has never been right, but we were never involved. This time, it's different.
Dhananjit Kumar and many like him are on the move, while many others have sought police protection till they manage a way out. Following the deadly October violence in Kashmir that resulted in more than 33 killings, which included 9 Indian Army personnel, 11 civilians and 13 pro-freedom fighters in different incidents, the administration issued an alert across the war-weary Indian-administered Kashmir. Intelligence reports warn of attacks on power projects, emergency landing strips and other government infrastructure. New Delhi has installed additional security forces across Kashmir after intelligence reports warned of more attacks.
We are doing our best to neutralize the terrorists who are behind the civilian killings. We have killed around 11 terrorists in October till now, and we'll do our best to ensure the safety and security of our people. It's not a security lapse. The targets were soft, and now we beefed up and more vigilant.
After India stripped Kashmir's autonomous status in August 2019, people of the region were promised development, prosperity, and greater opportunities. However, media reports suggest the situation in the region has slipped from bad to worse due to the absence of local political activities and implementation of rules and laws without taking people of Kashmir on board. Kashmir is a dispute between India and Pakistan since the partition of Indian subcontinent in 1947. The two have fought wars over the territory and claimed the region in full, but rule it in parts. The fresh spate of violence in Indian-administered Kashmir is seen by many as a politically motivated action. People of Kashmir urge the world community to help resolve this geopolitical dispute between India and Pakistan before they engage in war and devastate the leftover life. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
On Tuesday, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen greeted Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki at the beginning of a five-hour debate in the European Parliament. The niceties didn't last long.
Don't try to divert. That's the debate right now here about the rule of law and the primacy of European law. Don't try to run away and to escape that debate.
Morawiecki insists Poland's constitution has primacy over EU law, and this is infuriating the bloc's establishment. Amongst other things, EU authorities are worried the Polish government is trampling on fundamental rights, judicial independence and freedom of the press. Morawiecki insists hypocrisy is at play when rule of law is debated.
Some member states maintain tax havens. It means that in the EU, the richest member states are making even more money. How is this part of our EU values?
Criticism towards Morawiecki kept on coming, however.
For years, you have been infecting the minds of Polish people with lies and manipulation about European rules and regulations.
The Polish Prime Minister raised a myriad of issues, ranging from the EU's energy crisis to the refugee situation, but the focus repeatedly came back to him. Analysts say the EU is in no position to preach about rule of law in the light of its treatment of minority groups in the bloc, such as refugees. The problem has become worse due to recent developments in Afghanistan.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
Inside the chamber, Morawiecki was criticised over his country's treatment of refugees, but he certainly was not without his supporters. Lawmakers want the European Commission to withhold billions of euro in funding to Poland, but that could be a lengthy process. When the Commission initiates proceedings against a member state, it normally takes many years before there is a conclusion to the case. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of Muslims marched through major streets of Suleja to mark the birthday anniversary of Prophet Muhammad. For members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, the celebration has been going on for a week because it was designated as the Unity Week by the late founder of the Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini.
We all believe that the Prophet is our prophet, one prophet, no any other prophet apart from him. And he unites, he brought the Quran through Archangel Jibril, and he is the one that show us the path, the direction, and way to follow. The whole people in this town are now out to celebrate the birthday without any of us thinking that he will be paid.
Members of the Islamic movement said Muslims must unite to defeat the seeds of discord planted by enemies of Islam in the name of Shia-Sunni sectarian divide. They condemned the various terror attacks resulting in the killing of Muslims in Afghanistan and in Nigeria, which they said may not be unconnected with global arrogance to plunge the Muslim communities into chaos in order to steal resources. These incidents, the Islamic movement said, is the result of disunity. So Muslims around the world must unite. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria recall that their leader, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki, has always emphasized that unity among Muslims is about understanding each other and working together for the benefit of the larger Islamic Ummah. They said that although this is an auspicious occasion, it is important to recall the 2015 Zaria massacre, where more than 347 of their members were killed. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
With a few days to go to the fourth Mustafa Prize, the laureates of the Science and Technology Award are gearing up to nab the prize. The five winners were announced on October 12th in a press conference held in the headquarters of the Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation. They're now in Iran, visiting different scientific entities, including Iran's High Council for Cultural Revolution. They're here to talk about their scientific achievements and the significance of the international prize.
I'm extremely happy to be selected for this prestigious Mustafa Prize. It's a big honor and a great privilege to see that our collective effort with international collaboration, Atlas, Antares, and KM3Net recognized with this prestigious prize. And I would thank a lot and all my gratitude to the Mustafa Foundation for this noble and for this exemplary manner they are doing their work to promote scientific excellence in the Muslim world.
First launched in 2015, the Mustafa Prize honors scientific breakthroughs in the Muslim world. It is awarded to Muslim scientists in four categories of information and communication science and technology, life and medical science and technology, nanoscience and nanotechnology, and all areas of science and technology. This year, out of 515 works submitted to the Iran-based secretariat, five nominees were selected as winners. Laureates will be granted cash prizes amounting to $1 million.
In the last four decades, we have been working in the field of natural biochemistry, and that has resulted in the discovery of many drugs.
And that's why you are going to receive the award.
Yeah, I feel extremely honored to receive this very prestigious award. This award is already very well known globally because of its excellence, and the quality of assessment to select people is absolutely wonderful.
The scientific event is held biannually during the Islamic Unity Week, which celebrates the birthday of Prophet Muhammad. This year, the award ceremony falls on October 21st in Tehran, with the attendance of 50 scientists and scholars from 15 countries.
The Mustafa Prize says after four rounds, it has achieved its primary goal, to motivate Muslim scientists to compete for excellence. But the prize eyes for a bigger goal. It says it seeks to elevate science and technology in Muslim countries to, quote, revive the Islamic golden age in science. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A Natal Vice speech, Hezbollah Secretary General accused the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader directly of conspiring to initiate a civil war.
I need to tell you very clearly, the real project for the Lebanese Forces Party is instigating a civil war, because a civil war will lead to demographic changes that would put the Christians in one area to create a Christian canton controlled by the Lebanese Forces Party. There would be no place for anyone else in this area. This is our understanding of our experience with the Lebanese Forces Party and the path it is taking. One example is that they were ready to give the service of starting a civil war on behalf of the former Saudi ambassador Sabhan.
The leader of the resistance said the Lebanese Forces Party is trying to incite Lebanese Christians against Hezbollah, presenting it as an enemy. Said Nasrallah gave a detailed explanation of last Thursday's events, stressing that the security apparatus gave Hezbollah a confirmation that the first bullets were fired by militiamen from the Lebanese forces against the unarmed protesters. This, he says, was all part of a plan to drag Hezbollah specifically to internal conflict orchestrated by foreign sides. Nasrallah said the U.S. is also trying to provoke an internal conflict in Lebanon the same way it did in many other nations. Yet Sayyid Nasrallah stressed the scheme will not succeed.
Hezbollah has 100,000 fighters. We did not prepare them to fight a civil war. We prepared them to defend Lebanon and our land and water and petrol and natural gas, which is being stolen under our watch. We prepared them to protect the Christian and Muslim towns in Baalbek al-Hermel. We were killed in Chaldea and we were silent. We were killed on Thursday and we were patient. It does not mean we are weak or incapable. We are thinking straight and we have ethics. I tell the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader, don't miscalculate. Be disciplined. Learn from your wars and learn from our wars.
He warned that in the event of a military conflict, neither Israel nor the U.S. or Saudi Arabia will come to the help of any warring side.
Sayyid Nasrallah was clear in proving that the Lebanese forces had always tried to target the resistance. But he was also clear in the fact that Hezbollah will not be lured into internal fighting and that the resistance is a protector of civil peace and unity of Lebanon. And those who are pushing for civil war are at the service of a U.S. project in Lebanon and the region.
Said Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech tonight that the main guarantor for peace and stability is the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army. Therefore, Hezbollah will put its trust in the judiciary to bring those who martyred people on Thursday to justice. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Despite the harsh living conditions caused by the years-long Saudi war and siege, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and 13 other cities to celebrate the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary.
Today, the Yemeni people mark this occasion and tell the world that we can overcome all challenges by trusting God. Despite suffering from brutal aggression, suffocating siege, and limitless conspiracies, Yemenis have managed to achieve victories.
Yemenis said they gathered to send a message to the world that Islam is the religion of peace and so it's a prophet. They called on other Muslim nations to mark this day to renew their loyalty to the Prophet Muhammad.
Islam is a religion of peace. Our nation will stick to its identity and values regardless of wars and aggressive policies. Problems have only strengthened us in the face of the enemies of Islam.
For centuries now, Yemenis used to mark the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary as part of their religious culture. Such ceremonies include various cultural and religious events, like reciting verses from Holy Quran.
Dressed in green, the color of peace and mercy, Yemenis celebrate the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, which is a great blessing for the whole humanity. People, he say, Muslims around the world should follow the footsteps of the Prophet and stand against the enemies of Islam. Abdulatif Washali, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain is speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Syria is urging the UN Security Council to take action and make Israel stop its violations and illegal constructions in the occupied Golan Heights. Syria's UN envoy says that Tel Aviv's efforts to change the demographics of the Golan Heights will fail. Assam Sabah noted that such measures have no legal effect under relevant UN resolutions. It says that sooner or later, the occupied territory will return to Syria. Israeli officials are planning to quadruple the settler population there. The Golan Heights belong to Syria, and all Israeli settlements there are illegal. Now let's go to Mohammed Ali in Damascus and see what he has for us. Mohammed.
Yes, Syria's permanent representative at the United Nations, Bassam al-Sabah, renewed Syria's call on the United Nations Security Council to shoulder its responsibilities and exert pressure on Israeli authorities to stop its violations and the illegal acts against the people of the occupied Syrian Golan, including, according to al-Sabah, the crimes of killing, arrests, looting of private property, and depriving the people there from their natural resources, as well as blocking those who left the occupied Syrian Golan to work or for studying from returning back. He said that Syria will restore back the occupied Syrian Golan no matter how much time it takes, and that all of the measures taken by the Israeli occupation authorities are null and void and have no legal effect. Also, Dr. Bassam al-Sabah said that it is unacceptable anymore, this failure of the United Nations and the international community to force Israel implement UN resolutions and stop violations of human rights and international law. He said that forcing Israel to implement those resolutions can never be achieved without what he described as lifting the umbrella of protection provided by the United States and its Western allies, whether inside the UN body or outside.
Okay, thank you for that, Mohammed Alip in Damascus. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafian. Today, we're discussing Syria's Golan Heights. Let me introduce our guests in this edition. Author and journalist Arnold August is joining us out of Montreal. And senior research fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Samueli from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Let me start with Arnold. Arnold, let's start with a little bit about the Golan Heights, its strategic significance, how it was occupied, and who it truly belongs to.
To be quite blunt, the Golan Heights is actually part of Syria, part of southwest region of Syria. It was occupied by Israel and its allies illegally in June 1967. And since then, as you have mentioned, there have been innumerable resolutions in the United Nations against that occupation, demanding that the Golan Heights be returned to Syria. Syria is the owner of the Golan Heights. Many Syrians have been ejected from that region in the Golan Heights and have fled to Syria, always with the hope of returning to the Golan Heights at one point. Now, if I'm not mistaken, there are over 500,000 Golan Heights citizens who are in Syria waiting to go back to their own country. Now, there's been innumerable resolutions indicating clearly that Golan Heights belongs to Syria and Israel should leave the Golan Heights. Now, I have to say, as a Canadian, while the vast majority of countries that voted in favor of the UN resolution and in support of Syria, among the countries who supported the United States, consistently has been Canada. And we in Canada are fighting tooth and nail against that aspect of Canadian foreign policy. Of course, here, Golan Heights is very important for that whole region in Syria.
Now, Georgia, no country in the world except the U.S. has recognized Israeli sovereignty over Golan Heights, as you know. But Tel Aviv is pushing ahead with its settlement expansion plans. There are 7,000 new settlement units there. So what's the regime's purpose? Haven't they usurped enough Palestinian land already?
Well, the Golan Heights is also rich in natural resources. There's oil there, there's gas there, and above all, it's a great source of drinking water. So there is abundant material goods there that Israel wants to get its hands on, and indeed it has got its hands on. So that's why it's building these settlements to make it a fait accompli. In other words, oil and gas resources, water, all of which actually belongs to Syria, is now to be used exclusively by Israel. and hence the settlements, because the settlements in the Palestinian territory served a purpose. I mean, they made a two-state solution a non-starter, and that was always the goal. That, you know, you build so many settlements that it just becomes almost impossible to remove the settlements. And I think something of the sort is now being done now. So we've got in the Golan Heights. So we've got at the moment, well, I think 27,000 settlers living there. And the plan, the Bennett plan, is to have it reach 100,000. And once you've got 100,000, then the rest of the world can talk and talk about. Well, it really, this land is illegally occupied. It really belongs to Syria. But what are they going to do about it? It's now, it's a done deal, and that's the Israeli method, unfortunately.
Mm. Now, Arnold, serious action is what Damascus expects the UN Security Council to take over the illegal occupation of the Golan Heights. Would the Security Council do so, or would it let Syria down?
Well, let's look at the Security Council as a staff at this point. As you know, there are five permanent members: China, France, Russian Federation, United Kingdom, and of course the United States. Now, among the 10 non-permanent members, there has been some positive movement over the last year, because among the non-permanent members, in addition to Kenya, Mexico, and the Grenada, and Vietnam, you also have two countries, Norway and Ireland. So East Canada fought against the Canadian bid for a seat, a non-permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council, for many reasons. One of the general reasons was a continuous violation of the Charter of the United Nations, and also specifically with regard to the social policy over the period. And we voted against them, and other countries fought, Ireland and Norway, which, in our view, is far better, not certainly, but far better. We have much a better chance of Norway and Ireland joining other countries in the Security Council, as well as the amongst the five permanent members, for example, China and Russia. So, you know, the answer is we certainly hope so. I guess we'll have to see what happens. I'm especially looking towards China. As you know, the whole situation, geopolitical, international situation, has changed radically during and since the pandemic, which is not over. And one of the most important, or the most important player on the international field, whose voice, despite all its detractors from all over the world, especially the United States and the West, is China. China has become sort of a moral symbol for the world based on what they're doing with regard to the pandemic. So if China speaks loudly at the National Security Council, maybe if it does deal with the issue of the Golan Heights, then I think there is some kind of a possibility that some action will be taken. But as everyone says, including yourself and the previous and the other speaker on this panel, there's been so many resolutions passed against Israel. I mean, you would have to have a 24-hour marathon program on TV to do a resume of all the sanctions. But the point is, let us see how things shape up in the United Nations Security Council with the new phase, the new composition of that body.
George, how do you look at the performance of the UN Security Council? As you said, there have been lots of resolutions against Israeli land grab policy and occupied Palestinian territory and elsewhere. But the question is if they're able to push it and actually take some action.
Well, I don't see what action could be taken, because if there were a threat of the UN Security Council recommending some kind of sanctions against Israel, then it's an absolute 100% certainty that the United States would veto such a resolution. There is a chance, at most, that the United States abstains, but it would only abstain in a resolution that wouldn't recommend any kind of sanctions to be taken against Israel. So I don't set much store by the UN Security Council, because the United States always has Israel's back. I mean, it's quite striking that Donald Trump who broke with the international consensus on the Golan Heights, but the successor administration, the Biden administration, has not overturned that any more than it's overturned his recognition of making Jerusalem the capital of Israel. So, and even on the issue of the illegality of the settlements of, in the West Bank, again, the Biden administration is holding to Trump's position, which is that it's not illegal. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, I don't set much store by the UN Security Council on this issue.
Okay, Arnold, George just mentioned what I wanted to ask you, my next question. That's the Trump administration, you know, lent full support to Israel's land grab policy. It seems that the Biden administration is also following suit, don't you think?
Yes, Biden is definitely following suit, but in my view, you know, I've been studying American politics for some time, and in a manner of speaking, the Biden administration is more dangerous for Palestine than the Trump administration, because the Trump administration was openly, crazy, basically racist against the Palestinian people and fully supporting Israel. Biden is much more, how do you say, just in a more indirect way, using the liberal aura that the Democratic Party likes to surround itself with, as they did with Obama before. And though, therefore, it is easier for the United States through the new liberal phase of Biden to apply the same sanctions, the same policy, anti-Palestinian policy against the Palestinian people and in support of Israel. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to be careful about this aura of, the liberal aura that surrounds the Democratic Party.
Okay. George, how much longer would it take for what a Syrian official has called the umbrella protection or support for Israel to be shattered?
Well, I don't see it, to be honest. The Israel lobby in the United States is very powerful, has been powerful for many years. Politicians who have in any way threatened to break the bond that binds Israel and the American political elite, those politicians are invariably wiped out. I mean, there are some voices within the Democratic Party that that are critical of this relationship, unlike Rashid Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, but they are in a very small minority. Even the star of the team, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has shied away from any criticism of Israel because she, you know, she is very ambitious, and she knows that her political future would be very bleak if she ever came out against Israel. So I don't see this changing anytime in the foreseeable future, unfortunately.
Mm. Now, Arnold, what would it take to restore Syrian sovereignty over the Golan Heights?
I would say two things. Firstly, the resistance in the area against Israel, that is, from Lebanon, from Iran, from Gaza, and any other source of opposition to U.S. Israeli aggression and its policy of cleansing, ethnic cleansing. Now, when I say, I put emphasis on resistance coming from Canada, because in Canada, the tendency to say, well, we are in favor of the policy of divest in Israel and all that, but they shy away from what I view is the key question. Do you or do you not support the right of the Palestinian people, whether in Gaza or in Israel, to defend itself against Israel, and also the importance of supporting the Iranians, very courageous long-term policy of supporting the Palestinian people against Israel. So that is the first thing, supporting the resistance. And the other thing I would say, it is very important to take into account what is happening in the international scale. We've got geopolitical changes that are taking place. For example, there's a new group inspired by the Venezuelan government, Friends of the United Nations Charter, there are already quite a few countries that are part of this informal group in the United States. And their main goal is really clear, to oppose any attempt to settle or undermine the United Nations Security Council resolution and principles, which, of course, would include sanctions and illegal occupation against the Palestinian people and against Golan Heights. So will this new group, this formed about 2-3 months ago, will they be able to overcome the current stalemate and make the peace great in the international arena? The countries who have so far not taken a stand with regards to Israel will finally come on board and take a stand against Israel and in support of the Palestinian people and in support, of course, of the rights of the Golan Heights to get into, once again into the realm of the Syrian government.
Okay. George, what do you expect could happen eventually? Would Golan Heights be returned to its real owner?
Well, I'd like to think that that would happen. I don't see any immediate way forward because the point is that there has been an international consensus, since 1967, but probably even going back to 1948, which is that there has to be a just settlement for the Palestinians, and there's certainly been an international consensus on the return of the Golan Heights to Syria, and everyone has piously repeated that. Golan Heights is legally belongs to Syria, but why has nothing been done about it? Because Israel has this powerful backer, which is the United States. The United States wields a veto at the UN Security Council. There have been times when the United States has actually condemned Israel. I mean, for instance, over the annexation of the Golan Heights in 1981. I mean, that was the Reagan administration. Reagan administration actually supported the condemnation of Israel, but nothing flowed from it. The U.S.-Israeli relationship just continued, in a perfectly amicable way even after that.
Right.
So
right.
I don't see any immediate way forward. Now, maybe some decades down the road, like my colleague said, that things are changing. China and then this Friends of the UN Charter group, and maybe that could have an impact, but, not in the foreseeable future.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had author and journalist Arnaud August in Montreal and senior research fellow with Global Policy Institute George Samueli in Budapest. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
When President John F. Kennedy took office in 1961, he needed Senate approval for 779 of his appointments. That was a highly irrational way to run a government. 60 years later, despite efforts at reform and widespread recognition of the irrationality, President Biden needs Senate approval for 1,237 positions, an increase of 59%, as a new report from the Partnership for Public Service discloses. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Fred Hyatt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Government is Designed for Failure, and a new study shows it's getting worse. Stay tuned for more. When President John F. Kennedy took office in 1961, he needed Senate approval for 779 of his appointments. That was a highly irrational way to run a government. 60 years later, despite efforts at reform and widespread recognition of the irrationality, President Biden needs Senate approval for 1,237 positions, an increase of 59%, as a new report from the Partnership for Public Service discloses. Americans have gone from irrational to just plain crazy. How crazy? The Post and the Partnership are tracking 799 of those positions, leaving out some advisory boards and less essential jobs. As of this week, only 112 of them have been filled. More than 6 months into his presidency, in other words, more than an eighth of the way through his term, Biden hardly has the beginning of an executive team in place. Recently, a visiting diplomat told Express he was struck by the disconnect between Biden's ambitious rhetoric about rebuilding alliances, promoting democracy, standing up to adversaries, and his meager agenda. He asked, "Where are the policies? This isn't entirely fair. These are policies, but it's difficult to put meat on the bones of any agenda without ambassadors, assistant secretaries of state, and defense for different regions in the world, and more." At about this point of every administration, you start to see stories assigning blame for the empty offices. Republicans will ask why Biden has nominated only 323 of the 799. Administration officials would say there is not much point in stacking up another few hundred nominees for obstructionists such as Senator Ted Cruz, who has been holding up State Department nominees to grandstand his opposition to the administration's stance on a Russia-Germany natural gas pipeline. But the better question is, why do things this way in the first place? Start with the 4,000 political positions every administration has to fill. This is totally out of line with every other democracy, says Max Steyer, who heads the partnership. It undercuts the professional civil service and promotes a kind of short-term thinking, since the average tenure for Senate confirmed appointees is about 2 years. Unfortunately, most of the challenges facing the society and the government can't be solved in 2 years. In 1997, the General Accounting Office cited cyber policy as a high-risk area for the federal government. Are we surprised that decades later it remains so? Climate change, equipping the government with appropriate technology, retraining the workforce for a changing economy, these all demand long-range thinking. So, as Americans have sadly been reminded, thus preparing for public health emergencies, requiring that 1,237 of those 4,000 political positions win Senate confirmation compounds the damage. This situation discourages qualified people from serving. The partnership reports that nominees during the Reagan administration waited an average of 56 days to be confirmed. By the Obama and Trump administrations, the waiting time had doubled to 112 days and 117 days, respectively. And that doesn't count the excruciating pre-nomination months when prospective appointees are being vetted by the White House. During the Obama administration, nominees spent a culminating 452 years bogged down in the confirmation process. Torture for them, but bad for the Senate too, which has to take time away from legislating. And debilitating for the government. Even after 2 years, many of the jobs will be unfilled. According to Vanderbilt University professor David E. Lewis, 30% of positions in the past three administrations never received a nomination in the first half of a term. Steyer says, I'm not saying you solve this problem and everything else disappears, but if you don't solve this problem, everything else stays indefinitely harder. And how do you solve it? You could start by abolishing some of the jobs altogether. One study found an average of 83 layers between top leadership and essential workers in federal agencies, the report says. The report found at least 40 positions that have been vacant since June 2016. If they have managed this long without anyone in those jobs, let's take a look at those positions. But more to the point, the Senate and the executive branch could agree to radically diminish the number of political positions and the number requiring confirmation. Have the change take place in the future, so everyone's political calculation is uncertain. The Senate could insist on true accountability, confirm the truly senior positions, let those officials appoint the teams they want, and then hold those executives responsible for results. In turn, those executives would have an experienced, empowered civil service to rely on, with institutional memory and long-term commitment. The country would have a government capable of taking on complex problems. Imagine the board of directors of a large corporation appointing a new chief executive and then forcing that executive to operate without a team for months and even years. Shareholders wouldn't stand for such absurdity. Why should taxpayers?
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.